bianco, rouge blanc, It was a sound of Ukrainian revolution, and today we would like to talk about the 4th anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and 12 years since the beginning of Russia's military aggression against Ukraine. Today's radio show Between Revolution and Invasion, 12 years of the war in Ukraine, on Common Voices and Radio Korax, we, Lika Toloraya and
Anastasia Onofriev,
we would like to tell the story of Russia's aggression from the Revolution of Dignity up to the present day. Through personal stories and factual analysis, we will try to explain the chain of cause and effect that led to what is happening today. What are Ukrainians fighting for? And what does Russia want? We spoke with Ukrainian activists, soldiers, and human rights defenders who shared their reflections on the events that have unfolded in Ukraine since 2014 until today. So let's begin our story with the period before the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. What was the atmosphere like before the Maidan? What did people take to the streets? Why they protested against the government of then President Yanukovych? Let's listen to what people say about that time.
Somehow I was feeling something was going to happen.
At that moment, Ukraine was some great place on the map of the world. We were called as a part of Russia, some no names and unknown territory with some people who are like Russians but not Russians. And we were the part of a big empire, and we lived under the law of this empire. It means great corruption, no future, no law, because all the authorities, all the police, all the even army was under Kremlin. Totally corrupted system from kindergarten until the cemetery. The corruption was total.
У Києві ми мали досить цікаву річ, яка називалася «Година для України». Ми після роботи збиралися і навчалися. Тобто інтелектуали київські приходили і читали нам лекції. І це називалось «Година для України». Тобто ми вбирали знання для того, щоб їх віддати для України. Я пам'ятаю, я привіз свого сина Данила до Києва.
Is talking about his memories of this so-called Hour for Ukraine. It was basically like the intellectuals of Kyiv were gathering to deliver lectures to people who were just curious to know about different whatever topics. And then he tells the story how he decided to visit the religion museum with his son, and they were surprised that there were only like Russian works, like Russian icons, the works, and then he decided, like, why do they give us like the foreign works and tell us that they are Ukrainians? We have enough of Ukrainian art, like sacral art. And then he decided to go to the radio to speak about it. He was like angry about it. But unfortunately, the radio didn't want to release this this topic. That was the atmosphere.
Yeah,
by then.
That was the atmosphere. Just like people were gathering together and called this activity an hour for Ukraine. Like they were talking about Ukrainian things and calling this an hour for Ukraine. It was a very strange, weird situation because we lived in Ukraine. And as for me, I personally was very afraid to hang a Ukrainian flag in my window. I remember this. Because I feared someone might smash my glass. I lived on the first floor. You know, it was winter. I'm telling about before the Maidan atmosphere. And I was really scared because I lived on the first floor. It was a winter and I couldn't even hang my flag of my country. Then it was not so weird. But now when I remember this, it was like we Ukrainians were a kind of minority in our country. And I remember also in 2013, when Maidan began, when all this movement began, I wrote some post on Facebook. It had a couple of words. Has it finally started? You know, I was so waiting for this historic moment, like I was felt it, and I was so happy when something began to change and felt this atmosphere, because, you know, it was some tectonic shift, and every year I see this post and I think, yeah, my feeling was true, like something huge happened, because the time came to happen. The beginning of the Maidan. Yes, we would like to talk about how it started, and we will listen to Sviatoslav once again. He will tell us about the very beginning, how it started.
Янукович відмовився, збираємося на Майдані, а я в Києві, я приходжу. Є декілька людей. Перший день було просто, їх можна було на руці перерахувати. Це вже потім прийшли політики, прийшли з прапорами. А що цікаво, а їх попросили зразу вийти, зняти прапори. Чому? Бо вважалося, що всі політики, чи вони опозиційні, чи вони провладні, неважливо, що вони всі не є ще від народу. А ми, ті, що стояли на Майдані, хотіли, щоб почути наш голос.
The politicians started also coming, but they were asked like, to put down their party logos, like flags and everything. So they had to be there, like they were allowed to be there, but only like normal people.
And
then the politicians started providing with the equipment, like cars, the stage, and the technical equipment for the Майдан.
Ввечері ми приходили на Майдан. Були сотні, ну, може, в якісь дні тисячі.
Every evening there were like a few hundred people mostly.
І вночі прийшли і побили молодь. На другий день зранку ми почули, що тут це побили.
And then on the 30th of November, the special forces police, the paramilitary forces of Yanukovych came to Майдан, and they just tried to disperse it. They have beaten up, they beat up the youth, the students. And then the next day, this is when it really began. Like the thousands of people started like just flowing into Kyiv. And this is when the real revolution has started. Because people felt like, okay, this is it, this was the last drop, like, we can't take it anymore, we must go out, like, everybody. So then there were, like, protests all over Ukraine, like, people, also even small towns started going out to their main squares, the Maidan is this called in Ukrainian.
It was
no more about the, not so much about, like, Europe or something, it was against the authoritarian regime. This is what, like, awakening of the national identity. Because, yeah, people felt like we can't take it anymore. We must do something. Nobody taught us how to make revolutions. But people just self-organized because, yeah, they wanted change. People all over Ukraine started going out to their small towns even, and, like, to their to the bigger cities, and then organizing, just normal people started organizing transfers to Kyiv to go to Maidan, to live there. This is how the life started in Maidan. So people started living, really living there. Like, they started skipping jobs. The whole infrastructure was organized. There were some politicians, like Svetoslav said, and they were really standing for the people, with the people, against this dictatorship and against the unlawlessness, the lawlessness. There were even some oligarchs also providing material support to the Maidan. There were, it was like a motley crew. There were lots of different, there were all sorts of people. The left, the right, the apolitical, young, old, rich, poor. But they were all passionate and in its social, and passionate in social and ideological composition. It was like Noah's Ark. Even homeless people were helping making Molotov cocktails under the freezing temperatures because they were much more used to such conditions. People cooked tons of borscht every day, made tons of sandwiches. I even joined them once and played music, sang, organized learning spaces, helped the wounded. They spoke at the stage together with those high-ranked politicians. It was like a leftist dream come true. Then there were like volunteer units, samoborona, self-defense, that served like as ersatz police protection. LGBT confidential hotline turned into the emergency hotline for the Maidan. It was a true laboratory of the social contract. The borders that normally existed between the people, they just dissolved. It became so easy to talk to strangers. And like another curious thing, that Maidan was, some people say that Maidan was so clear that you could just eat from the floor, like from the asphalt. Also, even though in Ukraine people normally drink a lot, unfortunately, but there alcohol was completely forbidden, so everybody was sober. At the same time, also, there was this so-called anti-Maidan, the pro-Russian side. They consisted mostly of the police, militia, it was called back then, entrepreneurs, some politicians too, the military who sympathized with Russia, the ordinary citizens frightened by the news of the Banderas coming from Galicia, Lviv, to take everything from them to do I don't know what. Various also ultra-right individuals, including Russian patriots, including Russian citizens, they were brought to the east of Ukraine to those anti-Maidan meetings. And then there were also like monarchists and pro-Russian imperialists, or simply people who wanted to make some extra cash because, there were people who were paid. The right-wing activists actively supported these rallies, these pro-Russian rallies, and then in the beginning of the military operation, they started forming the volunteer battalions. One of the most famous is Azov Battalion. I also talked to Maria, a queer Jew who lived back then in Dnipro. I asked her about her experience of the revolution. It was very interesting because it was unusual.
For Ukrainian people, I was like pro-Russian in their understanding. And for pro-Russian things, I was pro-Ukrainian because I didn't understand them also. I didn't understand at the time the meaning of ideas. I wanted to change maybe the power, but I wanted it to be legal somehow. My focus was always on the right-wing part of the Maidan, because that was what I was afraid of. I have a personal history with anti-Semitism, so I was really scared of these people. And when I saw that they are the moving part of Maidan, the part who would fight, I was really scared that it would only make things worse. It was all the beginning. And it was escalating very fast. I remember also how the Berkut made very bad things with the activists. I remember one activist, it was winter already, yeah? And they made him like stand on the snow naked and they filmed it. And one of my colleagues who was Russian, she laughed at that. That's where I started to understand that there are some people among us are really taking propaganda too much in their brains. Because even I, who was like, let's all be just safe and stable and peaceful, even I could understand that this was some torture, and some people just wanted not to look at that way. They just laughed at the situation.
Did your views change throughout the period of the revolution?
They changed drastically. Like, now I know much more about Russia, actually. I understand how many nationalists in Russia are anti-Semitic and really doing some things, and nobody is stopping there because they're pro-Russian. We have problems with anti-Semitism. Yes, we have problems with right-wing people, but this is our problems, mm-hmm. not Russian problems, and not a reason to somehow intrude. And these problems are much, much smaller than Russian problems with all these things. Although that Maidan was a very complex event, there were a lot of queer people supporting that. They worked together with right-wing activists sometimes. They had to. They had common aims. There were Jewish people who worked with anti-Semites to reach the aim that was bigger than this rivalry between them. I think this is what makes Euromaidan unique. And this experience is to be learned by other countries also. I understand that nobody likes to change their power in that kind of way. This is not the best way. But sometimes you just don't have another choice when the state just insults you, tortures you, and gets you in prison.
So this was Maria. It was, I can totally understand her feelings in the beginning, her thoughts that, like, for me it was kind of the same. I was not sure what is going on. Actually, I think until the very end, I also didn't really understand what it was all about, unfortunately, but that's a different story. I would like to just highlight that it was really a true revolution because really, like, everybody was there and they, like, lots of sorts of different sorts of people that at normal circumstances would never even say hello to each other or look at each other. They were cooperating and they were, like, mostly doing fine. Of course, there were issues. Of course, there were conflicts, sometimes a bit violent. And there were, I would also like to give a voice to Taras. He's a left activist. But then he was a student and activist. And now he teaches politics in Berlin.
Oh, my God. Ich war seit 2012 in Linke Bewegung aktiv und wir haben damals schon diskutiert, wir haben diese arabische Frühling miterlebt, eben diese Massenproteste in Istanbul und wie die uns berichtet haben, was die gemacht haben. Ja, wir hatten schon sozusagen die Diskussion, was war uns schon damals klar, wir mussten sozusagen in eine Massenbewegung, können wir keine sozusagen ideologische Sauberheit. So, das war schon uns bewusst, aber waren nur theoretische Diskussionen. Und damals, das war so wirklich eine krasse, praktische Erfahrung, wie das eigentlich abläuft. Ne? Also für mich auch selbst, ne, war das sehr krass, als ich mit meiner Gruppe einen Oberstufenkurs gesprochen habe. Ne, dann habe ich verstanden, okay, die wissen gar nicht, wie das funktioniert. Also ich weiß das, weil ich habe das wirklich miterlebt. Dass wichtig war, okay, Polizeistationen zu besetzen, um die zu plündern eigentlich und Waffen so zu besorgen. Aber für viele westliche Gesellschaften, die haben das nicht durchgemacht.
Ja, I was kind of impressed. It was nice to hear that, like, what they write in the books, the theory is normally, like, different from the practice. And yeah, like, because the practice also, the theory also says that during the revolution you cannot be violent. But what if the violence comes from the state and, like, you have to, like, defend and protect yourself? This is what also people did in at Maidan. It is also important to note, speaking of the left, that one of the slogans of this revolution was Slava Ukraini, Heroim Slava. So it means glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes. During the World War II, this was a slogan of the Ukrainian insurgent army, the paramilitary nationalist group of the Bandera people that lots of people hate, because there is lots of like Russian propaganda saying that he was like a pure evil, that everybody in Ukraine is like his fan. But at Maidan, it like lost its radical nationalist context, and it just, what stayed is this anti-imperial, anti-Russian, anti-Soviet ethos of the words that remained. This is what stayed. This is also the meaning until now of the Slava Ukraini, Heroim Slava. What we mean now is also glory to the heroes that are dying for us, that are like in the extreme conditions protecting our freedom right now here, that we are in safety and warmth. So the life on Maidan started after the beating up of the students on the 30th of November, and since then there has always been this barricade, the paramilitary troops of Yanukovych. They were mostly just standing there like a wall, all in those bulletproof vests, helmets covering their faces, the metal shields and the guns even. People tried talking to them, asking kindly to change sides. I remember this, like the very impressive pictures, young women standing in front of this wall, of the often also young man hiding behind their shields and helmets, asking them to show their faces, handing out the flowers. There were also older women trying to talk to these men as if they were their sons. And they were asking them. So you can hear these women shouting and trying to reach these young men, like, son, you will not have the future. Put down the gun. Shame on you. Just go on our side. Be on the right side. Whom are you protecting there? Like, we need the protection. We are the people here. Don't go against the people, please. Be on our side. They're shouting them. I remember the story, there was also a priest that tried to negotiate with the barricade. He tried to convince them not to shoot, but then he returned with his hands covering his face. Apparently he failed. Barkut was shooting. The events of the Maidan were like a situation in which the special forces break into your house and you need to take decisive actions. But your arsenal consists only of punk lyrics, veganism, 100-year-old books, and at best the experience of participating in the street anti-fascism and local social conflicts. So this is when the most, this was like the really the second like turning point. There were a few of them, and Lika is going to tell more about it.
Yeah, Nastya, thank you for your try to describe the colorful society of the Maidan. I would like to say that it was some kind of ideal state inside the Ukraine. It was organized as we wanted to live on our rules, you know, and it was clear. It was some kind of education even in Maidan, for example. It was some created some kind of Maidan university.
Oh yeah, there was a free school.
Yes,
yeah.
You remember. Yeah. It was some kind of musical events, some cultural events, and it was dream life in dream country at that time. But
it was like utopia.
Yeah, just like you thought. And, you know, but the reality hit us with, you know, we had other side of this...
with machine guns,
Maidan. It consisted of some wall of these armed people, like Berkut. It was some kind of special police. They were standing against the protesters, and our idealism, I would say, hit this wall. Mm. And one day, you know, as far as Maidan was elaborating, we met some reaction, you know, and the first shooting, they were in February. The most tragic events of the revolution of dignity. Yes, in the Maidan, we call this a revolution of dignity. We didn't say the main thing.
Yeah.
And the most tragic events took place in February, like these days, 12 years ago, in the very center of Kyiv. The confrontation between protesters and security forces had sharply escalated. On February 18th, security forces moved to clear the protest camp. They have an order to clear all the square, you know, the central square.
The Maidan.
The Maidan, yes. And, you know, live ammunition, stun grenades and armored vehicles were used against the peaceful protesters without any tools to protect themselves. Yes, yeah. They only have some sticks,
some helmets,
self-made, childish, I would say, yeah. Armor.
Like toy guns.
Yes, it was different power, you know, between them. And the first mass casualties shocked the country, so there were many wounded on 18th February. On February 19th, the city center turned into a real battlefield. The trade unions building, it was some kind of headquarters of the protester movement's main building. It was burned out. And in the morning on February 20th became the darkest moment. In the early morning, protesters began moving up toward government buildings. Suddenly, shot rang out. Snipers and special police units opened fire. Within hours, dozens of unarmed people were killed. Those who were killed later became known as the Heavenly Hundred. More than 100 people lost their lives, hundreds were wounded. It was shock for the country because we were hoping that we will manage to negotiate and have some peace decision and the government will hear us, but it didn't happen. The deaths of these people, Heavenly Hundred, so-called, yes, became the turning point of the revolution. Within days, on February 21st and 22nd, the Yanukovych government collapsed. The president fled the country. And now guess in which direction he fled. In what country, Anastasia?
Maybe
like this, yeah. Of course, in the Russian Federation. It was not very difficult, yes.
Yeah.
And the same went for many other pro-Russian politicians of his side. And also for members of Berkut units. They also fled to Russia. Name it. Soon after this, Russia annexed Crimea and launched military aggression against Ukraine. So the aggression in Ukraine begins in 2014. I would like to emphasize and highlight this point. That later grew into a full-scale war. So the annexion of the Crimea. Anastasia, yes, tell us about this.
Yeah, so there were also, so like the Russian propaganda, lots of people also think there was some sort of separatist movement in Crimea and Donbass. But this is not true. There were also the protests in Crimea and in Donbass. People didn't want to be with Russia. There was no like separatist movement. This is all made up by Russian. Back in 2013, the first demonstration in Euromaidan Crimea movement started. The skeptics were like skeptical about it. They thought that it would not attract more than 20 people, but it gathered thousands of people. 20 to thousands of people went out to the streets because they also didn't, they were also dissatisfied not just with the Yanukovych regime. They didn't want to be with Russia, but they also didn't, like, they were also dissatisfied with their local regime, the local government of Ukraine, because it's autonomous republic of Ukraine. And there were, like, unfortunately, provocations from the anti-Maidan that was also happening in Crimea. The separatist forces, the so-called separatists, and the local government. The people of Crimea, especially in particular the indigenous people, the Crimean Tatars, they were afraid that annexation, or like better say, like joining Russia, which is not really joining, would leave Crimea internationally isolated without an economy or the future. This is actually what they knew that this could happen because this happened already before with other so-called republics of Russia and the other states that are like independent, kind of independent from the country where they were, to which they were part of before, and dependent on Russia. But actually it turned out much worse. And there were lots of propaganda against Ukraine in the same style, also like the Banderas are coming from Crimea, they're coming to Crimea from Lviv, they're going to, nobody actually knew what exactly those Banderas were supposed to do. And then there was junta in Kyiv. I share a Crimean Tatar about her impressions of that time.
В нашому місті дуже було багато зроблено, щоб люди відносилися до Майдану недобре, тому що в нас було, якби це називалося антимайдан. Повсюду були наліпки з цією назвою антимайдан. В тролейбусах в нас були такі телевізори, і там програвали відео пропагандистське, що якби настроювало проти того, що там відбувалося в Києві. Потім почали розповсюджувати дані людей, які були на Майдані. Я бачила просто оголошення таке на вулиці. Проснулася якось, з'явилися новини, що хтось захопив Раду. Ось так воно і звучало. Вони захопили хтось. Вони якби себе не безпозначок. Вони захопили, а потім в Криму усі воєнні якби об'єкти оточили, російські солдати. Але вони не казали, що вони російські солдати, в них не було ніяких позначок. Так. Це було не дуже складно догадатися, тому що просто якісь люди, солдати стоять, оточили.
So, Aisha is telling how the occupation started. Basically, at some point, the so-called green men, or sometimes they're called polite men, men in military form units, military uniform, they just appeared on the street. Nobody knew exactly, how and why, but everybody guessed they were like Russian soldiers. They had no marking signs like belonging to the country or anything. They were just standing there, not answering any questions.
Дізналися, що хтось захопив владу. Потім ми гуляли, бачили танки на вулицях, солдатів з автоматами.
And then at some point the government was put down. The Russian took over the government, the Russian forces. And this is basically how the annexation started. Yeah, there was some sort of referendum, but also fake. Because there were not so much, some people, I remember Aisha told me that some people said that the most people who went to this referendum, they were like strangers, they were not local, and then they voted for the annexation, and then few people who were also thought that maybe this could change something. They also went to this referendum. They thought that maybe they could vote for Ukraine. But of course it didn't do anything. And then it became like a nightmare for them and for the people in Crimea, in particular the Crimean Tatars, because and they still hope hoped for more than 10 years, they're hoping to wake up from it, but it's still going on, this endless nightmare. Because, yeah, after that, the repression started, the Muslim organizations were forbidden, although unofficially, like officially nothing much has changed. Well, just the hryvnias, the Ukrainian currency, turned to ruble, the Russian currency. And then the Ukrainian language was basically forbidden, pro-Ukrainian moods too. It was prosecuted. People started just disappearing. The activists, like the names of the activists, they were like published. They were on the streets, so everybody knew who like the activists, the pro-Ukrainian, the Krim Tatars. They were known to everyone. And this nightmare continues. There's like constant abduction of people, especially the Krim Tatars, the indigenous people all over the so-called Russian Empire. The Russian Federation, the indigenous people, yeah, like have no rights almost. Like they cannot be themselves. They don't have opportunities to learn the language. They used to be, as Shes said, they used to be like a Krim Tatar channel that was like doing the news broadcasting in the Tatar language. But then, in 2000, it was the only channel that was saying really what is going on. But then, it was, of course, shut down.
Yes, exactly. And I would like to highlight that very many people are detained. They took in prison. In Russia, and they have very long-term sentences, for example, for 15, 18 years for nothing, absolutely nothing. For example, the Russian army can detain some person just because they have blue-yellow nails. Mm-hmm. For example, I know these cases because I'm kind of human rights defenders, and we were documenting very many such cases. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing that all these crimes now are invisible, you know, because Russia doesn't allow any observant on their territory. Nobody can control what they are doing on their territory, on the occupied territory. But we will speak about this later. And now I would like to remind you that we are talking about the 12th years of Ukrainian war. Because, that the war began in 2014. The first invasion was just right then. And exactly about this, I would like to tell now about invasion, aggression on Donbass. After the government of Yanukovych fled to Russia, I would like to remind you, in 2014, after the Revolution of Dignity, when the revolution won, but we had some consequences of this struggle, Russia reacted to the protest of Ukrainian people, to their will to be free, to be independent in their own country, you know, in Ukraine. Ukrainians wanted to be just free. You know, it sounds weird, but it's the beginning of our struggle, which is going on till today. So, after the Revolution of Dignity and the annexation of Crimea, Russia launched a military invasion of the Donbas region. Kremlin-backed separatists seized parts of Donetsk and Luhansk. These are two big cities in the west, in the east of Ukraine. So you understand, this is just two separate cities. But Russian separatists took them and made some two so-called republic, you know, Donetsk Republic and Luhansk Republic. So they were created two republics of of each of these two cities, very weird, really, governmental units, but Russian position was like it's normal, you know, on the territory of Ukraine to make some quasi-republic. So to resist the aggression, Ukrainians formed the first volunteer battalions. Such battalions as Azov, Dnipro 1, and Aidar, the most famous of these battalions. These units were made of were made up of local activists, like the same people who were in Maidan, you know, from volunteers and patriotic citizens who defended towns and fought alongside the regular army. I would like to explain that till that moment, 2013-14, Ukraine almost didn't have any armed forces, because all of them were under the Kremlin and were ruled by Kremlin, and I would say even destroyed by Kremlin. Till that time, we just didn't have any army. It was some nominal, but absolutely didn't function somehow, you know. It was absolutely enabled, because there were no any warfare, absolutely nothing, just destroyed army.
There was no guns, no ammunition.
Absolutely, yes,
all.
No ammunition. Yeah. Everything was
even
sold or stolen, yeah, like by generals, like which were
Russians.
They were effectual. Pro-Russian,
the system, yeah.
Yeah, it was made long ago, yeah, and the result was Ukraine at that moment was unarmed, so we had to make some units from common people. And I, you know, Anastasia, I really remember when we had some first wounded person. They were in some sneakers.
Oh.
So they came from battlefield, like,
boots, like,
yes,
clothing.
Like they even had no any clothes, you know. It was like some improvisations, just some common people who went to battlefield to resist the aggression, armed aggression of Russia that moment, you know. And it was organized on the Maidan the same way they organized, improvised some battalions.
Yeah, the self-organization, it
absolutely
continued. The mood of Maidan continued, kind of.
Yeah, it was the buildings of their another country in the country, like another state in the state, mm-hmm. Ukrainian state.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we didn't have our own country, like, you know,
we were building our dream state, our dream country already then. And yeah, so this was also like the revolution kind of gave us so much uplifting. I remember those times. I remember in Lviv, where I lived, this city, there were the advertising posters everywhere, like the big boards. A drop in the ocean, it just said. It meant like we are drops in the ocean, like I am a drop in the ocean, you are a drop in the ocean, but together we are the ocean, together we can change something. So like the society is the ocean, we are part of the society. And this was also like the renaissance of Ukrainian culture. I remember there were like music festivals, the first there was the first the international day of music was celebrated in Lviv, like the, you know, this when musicians gather, the musicians play all over the streets. And then there was my favorite band from Lviv that doesn't really exist anymore, and I would like you to hear the song. It's very beautiful, that in a symbolic way, it's called Winter. In a symbolic way, it talks about what was happening back then, about this war.
Thank you. красна вода з твоїх грудей та й до інших людей. Земля горіла, тремтіла тілом, красні квіти під білим снігом. Колись прийде зима, накриє наші рани тілом.
To Common Voices, to Likoto Raya and Anastasia Onufriu, we are talking about the now, about the revolution and the war. So the show is called From the Revolution to the Invasion, 12 Years of War in Ukraine. We talked about the moods in Ukraine before the start of the Maidan revolution, what people were doing, that was like really like a social experiment of social contracts, that there were like lots of like all sorts of people, all layers of all educations, so from all over the country, they went out to the streets to protest against this dictatorial, the potential dictatorial regime of Yanukovych, the pro-Russian president back then. We talked about how it was like a utopia, the perfect country we all wanted to live in, the inside the Maidan, where people just really lived. We talked then how the Berkut, the paramilitary forces of Yanukovych then tried to disperse and like violently beaten up the protesters, and then surprisingly enough the right-wing activists they were serving as the defense, the Samoobrona units, the Irzatz police at the Maidan. They were really protecting us, and then they became the volunteers. There were also left who organized this free school, delivering lectures to the people. And then we talked about how it was in Krim, how the annexation happened, that like the just Russian military without, like, they had no Russian signs, but they were like military people, military men just showed up in the streets of Krim, and then later they suppressed the protest, the Maidan protest that also was happening in Krim. Then they took over the government, and this is how the war in Krim started. We talked to different people who were there. We talked how also at Maidan people tried talking calmly, trying to convince the Berkut, the paramilitary forces, to join the side of the people, to be with the people, not with the government. Then we talked about how the snipers started shooting at the protesters in Maidan, and this heavenly hundred, the first hundred people that died from this shooting. And then we talked also how this also led to the beginning of the war in 2014, and then our army was literally non-existent. The people were like almost naked. They didn't have like uniform, not talking about like their real equipment. Some the volunteers were finding the equipment, the clothing for them. Because the army was not existent. And then, but at the same time, it was the whole, like, very, like, uplifting moods in the society of Ukraine. We were so, like, elevated by the success of the revolution, because Yanukovych has fled to Russia. Yes, we won the revolution, even though the war started. But the revolution itself was successful. It was the renaissance of Ukrainian culture. There was music, there was like really, the culture started really developing, the translation of the films and everything. Yeah. The activism developed. I remember I was defending a park that was supposed to be cut. I don't think it really happened before. This is also like how my activism started. But, you know, at the same time, I didn't really understand the revolution, and it's like it is so sad for me to say, I must admit, I was still a pacifist. I believed this those Russian narratives saying that we just have to put down the guns. Well, everybody just has to put down the guns, and then there will be peace. I didn't really get the consequences, like how and why, the reasons and the consequences, unfortunately. And Lyuko is going to tell you more about like the what was happening in the in the politics of Ukraine.
Yeah, as Nastya said, people had very, very huge and great hopes for the future of our country, and there were really extremely high expectations of the politicians who came on the wave of this Maidan. You know, people believed the country will change quickly. We were ready for the change long ago. You know, and we were waiting for them because we knew how to do this all, and we were waiting for our government, our new government, to do the same, you know. We were waiting for deep reforms and that they would be carried out, overcoming of corruption. This was the main our aim, you know, overcoming of corruption, because mostly the most problem in Ukraine was total corruption, as we said at the beginning. Petro Poroshenko became a president after Maidan. And really some changes did take place. For example, there were some important reforms like decentralization, which gave more power and funding to local communities. Means some money and powers went from the top to local governments. Then it gave some economical autonomy to cities and communities, and it was a very successful reform. Then there were created anti-corruption bodies like NABU, SAP, and it gave us a hope that corruption will be combated. Like this, we were waiting for this. Then the army was rebuilt, of course, from scratch, I would say, because we didn't have an army at that time, and we had to rebuild it from scratch to defend our country from Russian aggression. The European integration really continued, and we got visa-free regime. It was very, very great victory, special, like personal for me, it was my dream, you know.
Yeah, for me too.
Yes, of course.
Because now we didn't have to like pay lots of money to find the ways to make this visa.
We are open to European space, and we came back to the family, I would say.
Yeah, true.
Yes, these were very successful reforms. One more symbolic reform was about the Ukrainian church. We have separated from Moscow church, which is on surf of FSB, as we consider till
it
now.
It is a fact.
Yes, it is a fact, but we will be polite. Okay.
Politically correct.
Yeah, politically correct. We are trying. But, you know, all these reforms had limited impact on everyday lives of Ukrainians, especially on the economic situation. For example, about failure, judicial reform moved very slowly. I would say it wasn't conducted at all. Oligarchs retained influence, like before were pro-Russian oligarchs, and after Maidan they became pro-Ukrainian oligarchs, but the system in general were saved, you know. Nothing changed for regular people, for citizens like this, and people were disappointed. And disappointment grows and grows every day. And the most important fact about Poroshenko's times, that the main proxy of Putin, his closest friend, Medvedchuk, became very influential during the time of Poroshenko's presidency. It looks like they just shared the sphere of influence. Medvedchuk ruled from Kremlin-ruled part of Ukraine. For example, he had a few channels, TV channels, and these channels were about